Welcome to a new episode of the Life Science Get Together podcast. Today with a very special topic that I'm interested in since I think it was the mid-90s when the internet was young. It's location-based services, and the company we are presenting today is Beacons Mind. And on the call, we have the CEO of Beacons Mind, I hope I spelled it correctly, Max Weiland. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Let me give a little bit of background where I'm coming from when it comes to location-based service, and then we jump into presenting your company and talking about what's going on in 2021. So it was mid-90s when I started at the University of Graz with my studies, and I discovered the internet, which was fairly young and new. I think it was 1992 or 93 that the CERN Institute in Switzerland put the World Wide Web into the public domain. And also Amazon, Jeff Bezos' company, was pretty young. He started it in 1994, and the year after, I wrote my first email, which was pretty amazing because I could send a message to the other end of the world, and a second later, it already was read. I mean, back then we had mailings. And at the university, we started discussing and thinking about what can we do with the internet in business. And in a research organization that I was a member of, it's called Evolaris, it still exists, we had glorious ideas what we all can do: autonomous driving, self-driving cars, locating goods in the world, supporting, especially on the consumer side, people when they walk by shops so that they get really specialized offers, that they know, okay, what's on in the shop. And we had only one problem: the necessary hardware didn't really exist back then in the 90s. So all these ideas and these visions we had, we just folded it up and said, okay, it will take probably 1, 2, 3, or 4 decades. I then went into merger acquisition and listed companies, and I came back to this location-based services and logistics, especially when I started training for marathon, interestingly. Because measuring the distances in training, knowing how quickly I can run 10K, 20K is key when a person wants to improve themselves. And it was 2011, so it was a couple of years forward. And I thought, isn't there anything out there on the market? I mean, meanwhile, 10, 15 years passed and the technology must have advanced. Companies like Runtastic and Runkeeper were fairly young still. And when I think back about the first runs I tried to track with my app Life or anything, it worked, but not very well. And since we have the pandemic, It's here for 1 year. So everything I consider to understand about commerce and how that works and what improvements like Amazon were coming to the world, and also all these location-based services that not only improved the life of marathon runners, but also the life of people working in logistics, completely changed. And I'm pretty sure that the shops will reopen soon. So what I'm curious about in this episode is to talk a little bit about what's possible on the shop level. How can location-based services improve the experience of customers, and how can that benefit companies? And I'm very happy to have you here today. This is my background, where I'm coming from, what I know about. It's pretty basic. Max, give us a little bit of background to me and the audience. Where are you coming from? What's your background?
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks for this magical introduction. You had to wait for 4 years longer in 2011 to get a solution that pretty worked out for and your purposes. So yeah, I'm very glad to be here. Some facts about my person, where I'm coming from. So I'm coming from the media side. You know, I did an apprenticeship in the media in a small agency in Munich by beginning of the 2000s. So I have like, I have like a feeling for media, you know. And then I was working for consultancy agencies from Munich to Hamburg. And then in 2009, 2010, I founded my first company. It was the Evium Group. And with still in business, still operating from Europe to China with offices. So still in the game. And at this time, you know, when the online marketing landscape appeared, there were just a few people outside there that did the management and the consultancy for big companies in different kind of verticals, such as retail, such as the industries, transportation, you name it. And then our idea was to found a company, and we were three of us. We were working for the Scout 24 group, like the holding of Finance Scout 24, Job Scout 24, and so on. And we did this for the verticals, and our idea was to build a company that is covering the consultancy part as the operational services. So in online marketing. And so the idea of Evium was born. It was evident in online marketing, so a name in the game. And the funny thing was, we were, you know, growing very quickly from 50 to 60 employees. And in 2014, then I had the idea of Beacon's Mind, and then the rest is history. But this is my my background, in what I did in the past.
The rest is history. So this is a nice thing. What is Beacon's Mind doing? What is its position on the market?
Yeah, so we are a tech company. We are headquartered in Switzerland, and we provide a solution, a SaaS solution, that we offer to retailers to make them open up location-based marketing as a complete, strong, new marketing and revenue channel, and bridging the gap between the offline, like the brick-and-mortar business, and their e-com business. And we do that with our solution that is combining two parts. First, we have the Beacon's Mind Suite software. That's our SaaS solution. We give the retailers access for. They can have a login there with email and password to manage the Bluetooth beacon hardware, which is the second part of our product. And the Bluetooth beacons we use, the beauty of it is they can be implemented very quickly in the lighting rail infrastructure of any retailer. And it's nearly a plug and play process to use our solution as well. And with our solution, we bring more customers into the stores. We have an impact to the customer loyalty, the shopping experience of customers, and in the end, of course, an impact to the revenues that retailers can make out of it. And our solution is able to, you know, once implemented into the retailer's mobile app, to localize customers via Bluetooth, via the smartphones, next to a store or inside a store. And with Bluetooth and our solution, we're then able to track the whole customer journey in store, to attract them with local offers that they receive in real time, even they had not the intention to visit the store, for example. And all of these location-based data and marketing aspects can be delivered in real time to the retailer that is using our solution. And that makes it why it's an outstanding and outperforming new channel for retailers with data they never had.
That's great. I mean, it reminds me of some ideas that we started thinking about in the 90s. So one of these ideas that probably also got matured a little bit with me getting older was that when I'm at home searching the internet for the product I need, and then I walk through the streets and come by a shop that actually has what I need and what I searched on the internet, that my mobile phone tells me, hey, wait. What you need is right in there, and you get this offer here. Is something like that possible with your solution?
Yes, that's possible. I mean, as we have the data of the customer, once we are allowed to use it for the customer, or for the retailer that is using our solution, we are able to to identify the visit and purchase behavior of each customer. And so the retailer that is using our solution can easily send out not only local push notifications, but also campaigns that really meets the preferences of any customer based on the last purchase or visit, for example. And that makes it so effectful, you know. And with that, like we increased like the frequency for retailers by 30+% that are using just the app users, of course, because we just can reach out, unfortunately, all the customers that have already installed the mobile app. Mm-hmm. And we have also an impact to the revenues as well, because the customer gets an approach at the right time once he is next to a store or in the store. And this is something a store employee would never be able to do, you know, because that would mean you need like thousands of employees in a store to approach any customer, you know. And even since COVID hit the retail landscape, it's just a matter of time where retailers will reduce the front line of store employees and need such technologies that are able to like having the approach, local approach in the right time, since one of their customers is outside a store or inside a store.
I absolutely can approve that approach. I mean, I think it would be very beneficial to my life if your solution would be installed in many shops. I just imagine, I mean, putting together a shopping list with the family, and when I start shopping, I get probably some help additionally, where to go, where the best shop is, where the next shop is. Also, what I really hate is searching for goods in a shop. So I know what I need, but also, maybe a sales clerk is not available because many people are in the shops. And then where can I find that? Is it also something that you can tackle with your solution?
Yes, we can. I mean, that is something like the local approach at the shelf or a different kind of area in the store, you know, like, as you said, like the accessories or menswear or womenswear, whatever you want to shop. And of course, we can trigger the right offers in the right different areas to let you know where you can find which kind of pieces in the store. But you can also, I mean, Bluetooth, you know, and that's also an important point I want to address. I mean, Bluetooth is a standard when it comes to a local approach to customers via their apps or devices, because as you know, I mean, Apple is here a standard. They have these AirPods, they're working with Bluetooth, they have the Bluetooth chips, the beacons inside. When you connect to your Sonos device via your smartphone, you also use a beacon that is inside the Sonos box. And even the free speaking unit in your car is using a beacon. So beacons are around all of us, you know, also in every device, because otherwise it wouldn't be able to approach a customer via the app, for example. And so, yeah, it's the only or the most efficient way to approach customers via a device, say.
Yeah, this is the part that was missing in the 90s, the technology that was rolled out in the last years, Apple and Samsung and all the smartphones around, and every device that became sort of intelligent and is wired and with Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. I mean, what I see in this discussion that we have right now is, I mean, I have many ideas, and it's great when I was in research, and sometimes I think it's annoying when I work with people to just brush out ideas, because all people have ideas. And you did something different. So you started executing on an idea. What in your life flipped the switch that you went from, I see that there is a problem, I also could imagine a solution, and then I start doing? What was the event that made you going?
Yeah, I remember very well, you know, it was in 2014, and a friend of mine came from a trip to the US, and he founded a company in 5 years ago and sold it to a big group in Germany. And it was also like a tracking technology, you know, and he says, hey, there is a very demanding topic. It's about physical web. It's like tracking the real world. And Apple recently launched the iBeacon technology. You know, that was quite a hype, by the way, in 2015 to 2017. And at this time, you know, I was recently moved to Switzerland to build up the outpost for Avium. Because we had some clients here and so on. And since my friend told me that there is a technology like this outside there, I couldn't stop thinking about, you know, of what to do with that and how to make like a product out of it. And so for me, it was pretty clear to make a product out of it and to let retailers benefit from it, mostly because they have this kind of gap. They couldn't connect or combine their brick and mortar business with e-com. And it was such an aspiring topic these days in 2014, 2015. So yeah, that was the time I decided to sell my shares, to make an exit on Evium and take the money and make something, if you so want, more effective, more scalable, with a big advantage for customers, yeah, for retailers. Yeah, that was the idea and the time Beacon's Mind was born in the mind. Yeah,
that's great. That's great. I think it's a difference to many people. To many have ideas and only a few start really putting it into a useful technology and into a company. Speaking of a company, a company is not a one-man show, and you also mentioned that you have built a team. I think this might be interesting for some people that have in mind that they could start a company but don't know where to start looking for people and co-founders. What was your approach back then? How did you put your first team together?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you feeling overwhelmed by the constant stream of dire climate news? Turn that concern into action. Tune in to the Climate Confident podcast every Wednesday morning when I bring you good news and real solutions from the front lines of climate action. Whether you're in business, tech, or just passionate about sustainability, the Climate Confident podcast is your weekly dose of optimism and inspiration. Subscribe to Climate Confident on your favorite podcast platform and start your Wednesday with hope and actionable insights.
Yeah, when I look back, you know, I still remember, even it's 6 years ago. But at this time, you know, just to make it understandable, you know, the situation. Once I founded the company, I was still in touch with potential investors, you know, private equity investors that I met in Zurich these days, and that I told the idea, but they were not like on board from the very first day. With seed capital, you need to grow, especially you want to grow up a tech company, you know, and later more on that, because we switched the business model quite a few times and even the strategy. But to come back to your question, I mean, I started with almost, you know, equity capital, like just purely equity, 100,000 Swiss francs I put in to found the company, because in Switzerland, you have that kind of company that is a stock corporation, you know, and that means you need to put in a six-digit amount, which is quite tough if you didn't make an exit before or whatever. And at this time, you know, we were really low in cash, so that meant I don't had like a million investment, and so I couldn't hire like 10 salespeople and 10 project managers and 10 designers or developers to start. So I had to be very creative how to use the money, because it was almost just my money, you know, and you feel every Swiss franc, every euro you spend, you feel it in the pocket. You know, there's a lot of skin in the game, as they say. So I had to do a lot of by myself, like with the right people. So I started to go to my network and I ask. And the very first employee was Anna. You know, Anna is today our COO. You know, and she is in the company since almost 6 years. And I hired her for Evium 5 years ago. So we are working 10 years together now. But at this time, I asked her, hey, could you imagine to move to Switzerland? I have an exciting project. And the funny thing is, before I founded the company, I told her we were on a business trip for Evium. Hey, I think I have a good business idea and it will be awesome, right? I had no idea where this will go. But she then said, hey, Max, I'm with you. Yeah, I will join you whenever you ask me. And then I asked her and then, yeah, she joined and moved to Switzerland as well. She was she's still today my right hand, you know, in the company. And with Anna, I did a lot of building the company up. And then once we received capital from angel investors, we also started to hire a developer and working with freelancers because we outsourced a lot. Because the difficulty in Switzerland is that you have such high salaries, you know, mm-hmm. that you're not able to have 10 employees from scratch on. I mean, if I found a company in Berlin with equity of 100K, you can easily just employ five people, you know, and they're happy with the salary and they are happy with the vision and that's it. But in Switzerland, where every second employee has a 6-digit income, it's not that fun, you know, so...
Yeah, I understand it completely. It's the environment is sometimes a little bit funny.
Yeah, yeah.
When we talk about starting companies, I work in life science and I'm doing that since 2006 and before in the 90s, I made my first attempts into starting companies on the countryside. I think I know very well what you are talking about when it comes to hiring people because the Austrian regulations are also very tough and straightforward and strict and not that flexible. Even back then, working with freelancers was not very easy and challenging because basically people needed to be hired and the term freelancer was not so much accepted in the legal system. I was trained in the 90s and I worked in my merger acquisition afterwards. So the approach that I learned how to start a company was a very slow and long one, which basically led through a thinking process, putting a team together, writing sort of business plan, and then at the end, incorporate the legal shell. When I started working with people from the United States and the United Kingdom, I learned a completely different mindset. They have an idea, they found a company right away. So not even knowing what they are doing. And there was also this interesting term, pivot. So it's quite normal to them to just flip the strategy, go from A to B and back to A and then to C and fiddle a little bit around. And this was a no-go in the listed companies that I learned basically how to outsource something and build something. What was your approach in that respect? Did you have a clear strategy, a clear plan fleshed out in 1,000 pages before you even started the company? Or did you take more the Anglo-American approach?
Yeah, we were more on the bootstrapping way to build up the company in the beginning, you know, because it's not like the typical or any company is different, right? And you can't start a company just on the paper or a business plan because there are circumstances you can't control, right? And the market is one of many facts that matters, and so we, you know, we had the vision, we had a clear vision, of course, what kind of benefits we want to offer to our clients, right? And we had a clear focus on retail landscape as well, because in the beginning, thanks to our first angel investors that had a background in retail as well. I got very quickly in touch with bigger retailers such as Tommy Hilfiger. And so we figured out like how could our solution look like, yeah, in the front end, what kind of features we could deliver to a retailer and what kind of benefits we should bring to a retailer. And And once we did all the funny presentations with the first pictures, and I have still some, you know, in the on the desk. I mean, it's funny when you see the evolution of screen designs you make and features from scratch on to status quo. And, you know, we started, and this is what I did. I mean, I started very early to sell the product, even the product wasn't there, you know, and it resulted. And I can tell now the public, I told the Tommy Hilfiger afterwards. Yeah. Once we signed the contract and did a successful pilot for them. Once I had this meeting, you know, with the chief marketing officer, I don't know, the Euro boss in Düsseldorf for Tommy, I showed him like a slide deck of the benefits we can bring with our solution, you know, with the beacons and how the solution looks like. And at this stage, you know, I had no software at all, you know, there was nothing. But there was the idea and they loved it. And then we negotiated and planned half a year. And in this 6 months, after the first approach, we developed the software with freelancers, you know. And then we built up like the business model. That means the pricing for the Bluetooth beacons we sell, for the installation services, and for the software itself. And then it was a process, a rolling process of on the business model and how it should work and how we could adapt our, you know, learnings to other retailers. And that's what we did in the beginning. You know, it was not everything based on a business plan. It was more an execution based, you know, based on real learnings we did with real clients. And that was one of the major learnings, you know, because this you can't pay with money. You have to experience it. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I agree with that. I mean, in a stable environment, probably it's possible to sit down and flesh everything out. But when the environment is dynamic or the technology is new and the idea is new, I love that approach to just go out on the market and find out with the customer what they need, what they buy into, and then start building. It's a great one. Let's move a little bit forward in your company history. So you started the company and then you developed the company over a few years, so 5-6 years. What were the key milestones in that development that are noteworthy in your opinion?
Yeah, when I look back, I mean, I think the very first important milestone was the decision to become SaaS. Company with an own software. And that was not pretty much clear in the beginning, you know, because in the beginning, we wanted to be a SaaS company, but as I told you, we had no idea to develop a software by ourselves, you know, and B, we had no cash either to develop by ourselves. So the funny story started in once we were getting the opportunity from one of our angel investors that connected us to Hackett London, a UK-based fashion retailer for menswear. And they were interested in what we have to offer or what we can do for them. And then I also showed them the slide deck and the features of things we could do for them. And my idea was, you know, for them to partner with a provider out there that is able to develop a software with us. So it's like it's not like a joint venture, but it's like, you know, the idea was to partner with them and then having the learnings and building maybe later on software. And they hadn't the software because there were just a few providers out there. And so my conclusion and learning was then like to build an own software. And that was like the first major milestone, the most important one, I would say. Yeah. Based on a real learning. Yeah. And if I think of a second important milestone, next to the funding of the company and the trust of our first angel investors, I could inspire for investment in the company, was the moment we received the very first project contract from Tommy Hilfiger, you know, in 2016. And then quickly afterwards from the Bollack Guggenheim group, which operates the Marco Polo and Guess stores at that time in whole Switzerland. And these both, you know, companies gave us that trust and the contract where we could pay the first bills, you know, and we were not profitably in the first year. I mean, with almost no product or very later stage in that year, we did 150K in revenue. So it was not bad, right? If you think on to the US where they claim to if you build up a SaaS company, you have to first build a product that takes 5 years. And afterwards you can start having builds, you know, and in my opinion, it must be quicker. And I wanted to earn money with the software because we also bring benefits to retailers. So the trust of these two like key clients was also a very important milestone. And I did take a note on that because there are so many more milestones, you know, and I try to have the essence of the most important ones. The first most important milestone in my point of view was next to development, the company, of course, the hardware, the software, and the proven business model. It was the trust of our respected client Adidas in 2018. And you see the second milestone and the third are almost the same, right? Because it's about trust. It's about clients that they gave us that trust and like us as company that were able to deliver benefits to them, you know? And Adidas came to us in 2018 and with help of their trust, you know, and we developed our collaboration, we could build a successful project, and that resulted in a global rollout of our solution in means and implementation in their stores in over 25 countries now. So I would say this is the very, very most important third milestone from my perspective.
Awesome. Like I can really relate to that. No matter how many companies somebody starts, I think the process of seeing a problem and then having a solution in mind that I think it can work is one of these amazing, mesmerizing and magical moments. The second one is putting a team together. No matter what role I'm in, it doesn't matter if I'm a CEO or if I'm just an advisor or whatever role, but bringing the idea and the concept of a solution into the mind of another person and convince them that it might be a right way is awesome feedback when the first person says, okay, yes, I'm with you. I'm walking with you. And I think the third one is messing around with the business model, trying things out, especially in the beginning. I mean, it's so easy to see what problems exist, but it's so difficult to find people who not only see the problem, but come with solutions within a team and really put this solution to work instead of complaining and say, this is not working and that is not working and that is not working. I think finding executors in the beginning. And then, of course, I mean, having customers buying in. But we are talking about solutions and successes, and this is a great thing. I would like to give it a little bit of another turn. Have there also been significant problems and hurdles that you needed to overcome to create success? Let's look a little bit on the not so nice side of running a business.
I mean, you know, in an entrepreneur's life, you have always hurdles and you got always challenged, you know, with new situations and showstoppers and roadblocks you have to push out of the way, you know, on the way to building a company. And yeah, there were really not just a few. I mean, many of them, you know. And to answer your question, how did we or I overcome hurdles with success or create success? I mean, I did a lot of mistakes, you know, of course, because we were in a business that we were never been before. Of course, I had experience in consultancy business, sales and marketing, but software development and hardware distribution means a complete different thing. So there were some moments hurdles we have to overcome, you know, next to the biggest challenge, the liquidity. I mean, the liquidity is like the air you breathe, you know, as an entrepreneur, because without cash, you can't make any step further, you know, because you can't pay salaries, you can't pay for R&D, for the software development, and even for sales, you know. And that means sales was the most important thing, or the biggest hurdle to overcome to have success. And that means to identify the right clients over the network with the right people to get in touch with, to inspire them for the solution we offer. And that was one of the biggest hurdles I had. I mean, they have to inspire people is if you have the right product and the right approach, is not the most complicated thing on earth. But if you have no cash, you know, to pre-finance the development, you know, then you can't realize a project. And so I would say to finance everything was the most hurdle we had here, and that set challenges every year. Yeah.
Yeah, I know that. As I said, I'm working in the most of my time in the life science industry, and every business plan that I write starts with we need 1 billion to bring something to patients. So how can we raise that money? And the interesting thing, I mean, I'm in the process of reading this book. It's Principles from Ray Dalio. And he points out in his book that entrepreneurs should sit down and always think about what did they learn and what principles did they discover, and write them down and publish them. So inspired by this thought from Ray Dalio, I want to ask you the question, with all your experience you got from starting companies, funding companies, founding companies, building companies, are there some noteworthy principles that you learned and that you think are worth sharing?
Yes. I mean, to answer this question properly, I'm afraid we don't have enough time, right, for that in our podcast. But honestly, I learned most of it from mistakes. And by the way, I did a lot of mistakes, that's for sure, I told you. And there is a principle, yes, I would say. And the principle is, you know, to always stick to your vision you have, and setting you goals every day, you know, because building up a company is a process. It needs endurance, and you need to have a lot of resilience, you know, to overcome all the hurdles. And the principle is just stay your ground, you know, like believe in the idea, believe in, that's very philosophical, but to believe in yourself is the most important thing, because there is no other person that can make the company grow. You know, of course you can grow a company with money, but if you are not working on goals and not achieving that goals, you can't be successful. So no one can cover the work you can do, and that means stick with it and work on it every day. That's a principle I've learned. Yeah.
Great. I mean, I agree to that. Sitting down, even especially in the bad days, I mean, the good days usually take care of themselves. But not every day is a good day when we're all human beings. Mm-hmm. And also on bad days, sitting down and working a little bit, at least towards the goal is, it makes a difference in the long run. It like Warren Buffett says, it compounds. So it's compounding interest.
I mean, you don't, to be honest, right? You try to make the best out of your mistakes, and there are many principles to write them down, you know, to learn from it. But in the end, you get an instinct for which could be good or not good or not, you know, going well. Because you build a feeling for that, you know, based on the learnings you make and the failures. Yeah. you have also your successful moments and your successes, but the most you learn is from the mistakes. Yeah. And I'm not sure if the author of the book you read, did he find any company so far, or many, or where does the experience come from?
Ray Dalio is one of the investors that were famous in the 80s. Mm-hmm. It's quite funny reading his book, because it was the time when computers were young. Also, I mean, some entrepreneurs of these days, Steve Jobs, for example, he did pretty much something that you are doing. He sold software and hardware, like Bill Gates was just on the software side. And Ray Dalio describes in the book how he has run, how he started working for hedge funds, how he started his own fund, how he messed everything up and had to go back to zero, and how he learned out of his mistakes. And this was also the thing that he mentioned, that he learned that pretty much the same what you are saying, that through making mistakes, he got better. And also an interesting part in this book is where he says that he puts together a team as sort of meritocracy. So where they share basically their learnings and their experiences, and where they share also their opposing views of the right solution. And he says the only way to come to the right solution is to listen to the pros and the cons of the team, and not just surround yourself with people who just share your opinion because you pay them. And he basically ran the fund, I think, up to 2009, if I remember it right, and is now a retired billionaire in the United States, and continues sharing his wisdom like Warren Buffett. It's a book I highly recommend reading. And he basically invested his money in listed companies. And you also made the decision that at one point in time, you took your company public. What drove that decision?
Many learnings and mistakes as well. But to be honest, before I explain the process, I want to make understandable the situation of startups in our economics here in Europe, especially in Switzerland. I mean, if you're a tech company in Switzerland, you know, not coming from the fintech side or the prop tech side or biotech side, it's pretty much tough to find investors, you know, not always, but often, you know, to attract them or inspire them to invest 10 million, for example, you know, in one financing round. And so we did a bootstrapping every year. That means we did fundraise every year, almost with private equity, as well as with institutional investors. For example, in 2017, Osram joined the company or acquired a minority stake in Beacon's Mind based on a strategic partnership that was going on before. And after 5 years of fundraising, you know, and recognizing that we have a global demand on our solution, and we rolled out at this time already to many countries for Adidas, among others, we recognized that if we want to have a global scale, for example, we need a bigger investment, right? And with that, we were figuring out and did a lot of research if how do we can get this. And one of the attractive things was going public. You know, of course, there are some regulatory things we have to fulfill or to meet. But in the end, it's a good way to work on a global visibility, you know, and credibility as well by the nice fact that you have access to the capital market. And you could even raise higher amounts of tickets, you know, to finance the company. And that's why we decide, based on the fact of financing, credibility, and global demand, to go public. And right now we can see the results, you know, without telling you inside informations. I mean, you have seen on the media, we have a way much more visibility than before. So even in that aspect, it worked out. And so it was a good decision in the end.
That's great. Now I'm a huge fan of IPOing companies and giving them more visibility. Also like investing myself in listed companies, basically. My opinion, it was my honest opinion until June last year, then we had Wirecard. But usually listed companies have stricter compliance regulations and rules than not listed companies. And especially when it comes to global businesses, I'm still in huge favor of these principles that listed companies must have a minimum compliance and audit processes integrated in the company, which at the end of the day also helps the executives and the founders to keep their companies on track because they get just more feedback into their decision-making processes. What is your opinion on the except this visibility? Which of course stock markets have, but what is your main advantage in your opinion when you think about being a listed company? What was the outstanding advantage for you?
I mean, the outstanding advantage is the credibility, right? Because if you have an official share price issue and the company is running successful, it gives also your retail clients or the clients we approach, the retailers, another level of comfort, you know, because they partner with a serious contractor, for example, that is a listed company. So they know everything is well structured, you know, even in the financial way, as in the way of the corporate governance, I would say, because it takes a lot of things to that is required to meet, you know, once you are a listed company or on the way to it, because you have to submit a prospectus, for example. You need a different accounting standard. You report your half year and your financial year results, you know, and all of these pretty things. And that gives another level of comfort. And even for shareholders, it's a good way because the shareholders that invested in the beginning, you know, they get something back from the company. You know, they have a share price issue. They can trade or they can trade with the shares on a market. And I think both sides win, you know, the company with its shareholders as well as the clients we approach.
It's funny hearing that now in 2021 and just thinking back while you were speaking, you thought back to when I first worked with listed companies. It was the 90s. And back then, I mean, listed or not listed, the usual process was putting together one annual report, mostly 9 months after the year end. And this is how companies were run. No structured budgeting processes, no monitoring internally, no monthly or quarterly meetings. It was basically one meeting every year to present the annual report. And when I think now, one of the outstanding examples, in my opinion, is a fund from the United States. It's ARK Fund from Cathie Wood. She was last year voted as the best stock picker by Forbes. She had a return of 200% in 1 year with her funds. And she's reporting every day what she's doing, what her team is doing, which companies they buy. They're putting out research reports. And it's not only beneficial, I think, also when I think about companies that are listed, they also have quarterly reports and some say it's work, but in my opinion, it really helps to challenge the executives to think about their business day and night and find ways to improve it. Would you agree to that, or is it more a burden?
You know, if you are an entrepreneur by heart, you know, as I am, because I started a company with own money and not just with venture capital only, it means I have a lot of skin in the game, you know, and that makes you think automatically every day, you know, about your decisions, about the future. You know, you have scheduled the next week fully, mostly, you know, because you know exactly what you want to achieve. Mm. And if it's a different thing if you are just I won't reduce it, you know. But if you're just a manager, like an executive manager, like a CEO that is hired or employed by a company, and you have no skin in the game because you're not a significant shareholder, you just get your salary. I mean, you get a ton of salary, millions mostly, especially when you're managing a hedge fund. Then it's a different thing, you know. Then I would say, yes, it makes sense. It's good for the shareholders to challenge the executive management. But for in our case, you know, because I'm the founder, I'm in the board, I'm the major shareholder of the company. The shareholders trust me, you know, because they know I have skin in the game. They know that I'm just doing Beacon's Mind. I found it, I executed it, and I want to make it big now. And so there is no need to challenge with a daily reporting, for example. So for me, I wouldn't say it's a burden. It's a normal thing, you know, because also the shareholders have right to know what's going on in the company. And I'm aware that I'm the major shareholder right now. It's not my company. Yeah, you know, I'm not the owner of the company. I'm working in my position as a CEO for the shareholders, you know, for the company. That's my understanding of my job, because of course it switched from founding the company as the only shareholder or one of two or three until the point we have right now, you know, where we are open to the public, and I don't know the exact number of shareholders. So yeah, the times changed. I'm aware of this, and for me, it's not a burden. There's no need for a challenge, and for an executive manager that is employed, I would say it makes sense. Yeah, even they won't hear it.
Yeah, I agree to that. And I love the point that you made that basically you as a CEO are serving your company, are serving the employees and the shareholders, and you are working in the same direction than they do. And in the end of the day, it should also be that way, that a CEO is compensated when the others are compensated. So it's the better he's doing his job or she's doing her job, the more compensation is fine. When I look at your company, I mean, usually I thought doing one IPO is sufficient. So you start a company, you get it listed with all the benefits that you mentioned. And that's it for a while. And then I got the information that you are listed on two stock exchanges. What was in the core of the decision?
Yeah. So first of all, I want to point out, you know, it's the result of our strategy, you know, because once we were listed at the Euronext stock exchange, we had access, of course, to French speaking investors, even to the landscape of potential retail clients, because Euronext is in Paris, as in other countries and capitals, is a well-known brand, you know, and you have a lot of investors there, even tech investors. But as we are in Switzerland and Austria seems so much closer to us, it made sense to do a listing also there, because we have access to a new capital market. That means to German-speaking investors, so very close to our headquarters in Switzerland. And it's the market of Austria is pretty much comparable with the Switzerland's markets, you know, in regarding of the size. So much more compatible than Germany and Switzerland because of the size alone. And for us, it was a way to reach out to German speaking investors and potential clients. And that was the decision of us to also list the company there at the Vienna Stock Exchange.
Is that such a huge difference? Well, you come from the company side and just tried to figure out on the side of the retail investor, does it really make a difference where the company is listed? Do you see such a huge difference in communication, in reaching out to parties with a dual listing? Is that really such an impact?
Yes, it has a massive impact, because you are now in a new country, you know, in Austria, and you get a lot of traction there as well, you know. And it's like it has many benefits, you know, in the ways of marketing for the brand awareness, for Beacon's mind, next to the fact that we are listed there and having access to the investors. Because also Austrian retail brands are now, you know, recognizing, okay, Beacon's mind is there. Mm-hmm. They may never heard before of us, but once we have been announced as a listed company in the direct plus market, then we get a lot of more traction than before. So from my personal point of view, what I see is, I think it worked out. Yeah.
Yeah, probably you're right. Media attention when you're listed is probably a little bit better. And it's the trust maybe that when you join the community with a listing and the stock exchange trusts your company with allowing you to get, I mean, I think it's not automatically, or isn't it? So that you just say, I get listed and it's done in 5 minutes. It needs a little bit of work to get it done.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And this creates probably trust, and the human touch, I think, is still important in business, even if when we are living in the internet world. Dual listings, benefits of an IPO. I think this trust, this human trust is probably really the best argument why not only one listing is sufficient, but also to spread out in the market, especially when you are working with retailers who reach out also to consumers. And it might also help the consumers like me to get your brand. When we talk about the retailers and the consumers, what changes do you see in the way we are conducting this day-to-day retail businesses? What will happen in the next 10 years, in your opinion?
To project the next 10 years, it would mean to have a magic mirror, you know? Because you know what happens in just 1 year, you know, who had expected this, like COVID, just 1 year. And to project 10 years, there are a lot of like technology projections out there, how the market will transform. But in my personal opinion, I think we see a lot of changes and transformations going on there in the usage of smartphone devices, you know, in the physical world, combined with e-com. Because bringing both worlds together in real time is like the last step to a whole like digital world, I would say, because it's like the last step, you know, to bring e-com and the real world together. And in my opinion, and we see it on a few examples, you know, just to mention one. Amazon with their Amazon Go stores that are nearly contactless, and by the way, also with NFC technologies such as Bluetooth. So in my opinion, we'll see a massive transformation in the physical web environment, and means reaching people locally in real time with NFC technologies, as said, such as Bluetooth. And we will also see retailers that will centralize the user in the middle of the brand strategy, and a good role model here is our client Adidas, because Adidas launched their own the game strategy recently, and that means they put the customer in the center of all of their activities, and they want him to be on the mobile app, you know, to let him benefit from the gap or the connection between physical stores and e-com. And that's why, among others, they use our Bluetooth beacons, for example, because with that centralizing strategy, they are always with the client, you know, with the customer. That means no matter he is or a customer is visiting e-com, no matter he or she is in store, they always have a direct local approach to them, and they can connect like and building a physical web out of it. And I think this is the way it goes in the next maybe 5 years, you know, maybe we see it earlier. I don't know. I mean, nobody knows, but we have feelings right now. We have indications, and big brands with high brand awareness are going to be offline as well. You know, there are many or tons of examples like Doc Morris, like the pharmacy chain that started in e-com and now building a huge infrastructure of pharmacies on site where people can get their purchases they reserved in the e-com right away after a store next to them. And this is the way it goes, you know. And if you ask me, I mean, I won't stress it too much because you see it every day in the media, like which kind of impact COVID will have and what kind of COVID or post-COVID world we were living in. But if you ask me, I think people will be like, they will have a complete new level of appreciating local stores, you know, being together, shopping around by themselves again, not only online. And you see it in the UK, in London, you know, when since the lockdown was disappeared, people went outside, you know, having party, were shopping as hell, and that will happen, and they will have a new appreciation level of local stores. And so, yeah, we see a lot of more technologies, even in our vertical or segment, that will appear to make the physical web come true. Yeah.
No, this is funny that you're saying that the COVID was a huge hit to all industries and to all people, especially with the lockdowns. And last year, I was pretty amazed how well organized the world really is. So one of the fears I had when Austria went into lockdown is I was absolutely not prepared. So I didn't read the newspapers and I was not aware of what was going on. I just did my business and was not expecting something to happen. So I had not bunkered a lot of goods. So I was, where can I buy that? So when everything is shut down, I need to replace clothes and running shoes and stuff like that. And I never considered that I would buy that stuff from Amazon. Mm-hmm. And this was one learning. I mean, I can buy it on Amazon. I get the cheapest price and I get it delivered right to my door for zero expenses as a Prime member, which was a great thing. And then happened what you were saying. Social life was turned down to zero. And suddenly, I mean, I always hated going shopping on the weekends, running through shops, trying to find the right things. I mean, your solution 5, 10, 15 years ago didn't really exist, so which could have potentially helped me find the goods quicker. I really hated it. But with the pandemic and with the social life turned to zero, I realized that shopping had a social component. It's talking with people in the shop, talking with the shop owners became a completely new quality. And I really wonder what of that will stay and remain in the world. And there's one question that pops up in my mind to you. When we see all these changes and what you described, where do you see Beaconsmind in that game? What role do you want to play with your company in the future?
Yeah, I agree. It has a complete new, it will generate a complete new of experiences, I guess. And our way, you know, is to become a standard in when it comes to location-based marketing, because we have that kind of retail scope. We have a proven track record in bringing benefits to retailers. And you might see us also in the future in different kind of verticals, you know, like in the transportation, in hotels, in the industry itself. Because we can be implemented anywhere where is a local infrastructure, you know, that you can reach out to customers via a smartphone. And this is where I see Beaconsmind in the future, you know, like we are building a big customer base, like a big client base, make our experiences, we launch new products that will bring benefits to the market. And I want us to become a standard when it comes to connecting physical retail stores with their e-com and bringing benefits to the verticals. That's where I see Beaconsmind in the future.
That's great. As I said, I was working at listed companies, merger acquisition, controlling, and part of that was having interviews during the budget process. So, and you are a listed company, so for the old days, I would like to ask one question. What are your midterm plans?
Yeah, you know, I can just drop information we have publicly announced. But what we want to do is, of course, using the moment we have right now, you know, and benefiting by and taking advantages of the post-COVID situation. And that means we want to distribute our solution on a global level and rolling out to new markets. We have recently announced that we go to the Middle East with an outpost, that we plan to go to Asia Pacific by end of 2021. And then we want to be also on site for retail clients in the US by 2022. And these are the, I would say, it's not that short term because it's more midterm, but with that growth strategy and the fact that we are on site into new markets, the reach will increase and we will get the chance to bring the benefits of our solution in many retail infrastructures. And let them benefit to cover the post or and to manage or benefit from the post-COVID crisis properly. And that brings us to the point what we want to become, the standard in location-based marketing one day.
The standard in location-based marketing worldwide. Globally. So you're not only restricting yourself to France, Switzerland, and Austria or the DACH region. You are really reaching out for the world with your company.
Yes, exactly. We grow with clients into new markets. And in the future, we want to, of course, being a bit more proactively, because there are many countries out there that still not use that powerful channel. Mm-hmm. And it's our duty and pleasure to bring them the benefits from our solution into the market.
Yeah, I can make up a lot of use cases in my mind, and I'm pretty sure your technology will have a great impact in that world. And hearing that you are standing for growth also is very interesting for me as somebody who might buy or buy not your shares, and for all other shareholders, that you are working on a growth strategy. And this is also the way that shareholders can benefit from your company with there is only increase in value when you grow as a company and when you don't restrict yourself to local markets. So when I think about the situation that you will definitely become successful, I'm pretty sure about that, more successful than you are. And maybe not now, because we are not still in Austria, not allowed to meet up, but maybe in future, we will also have the opportunity to meet in person. And let's just imagine that at one of the events, it might be a startup event, where you have to have a speech or a keynote speech on stage, and you're in a hurry to the stage. You make your way through the crowd, hopefully in future, and you feel that somebody grabs you on the shoulder and say, "Hey, you are Max, you're the famous entrepreneur, and I want to start a company. Can you give me one advice?" And you say, "Hey, my friend, I have to go to the stage. I don't have time." And he says, "Please, just one advice. Give me one advice quickly." What would that advice be?
So I'm glad that you asked me that question, and that the entrepreneur that approached me is a he. Yeah, because then I would promptly reply that he should always listen to his wife, you know. And if he doesn't is married so far, I would recommend him to always listen to his instinct, you know. Mm. To be honest, you have to, you know, always listen to yourself in the first place, because there, as said in the beginning, there is no one else except you building a company, you know, because it's your company in the beginning and it's driven by your passion, by your mindset, by your resilience and all the goals you want to achieve. So at a later stage, of course, you can work with investors that are acting as sparring partners and having the same goal as you have. Of course, investors always want to make more money out of it, mostly. So that's what they claim. And no, that's their job, to be honest, and I appreciate. And of course, never, you know, never, it's very philosophical, but it's true, you know, never back down, never give up, let everything in flowing, you know, and be a yay sayer. Yeah. That doesn't mean you have to say yes to everything, but try to keep everything in flow, you know. Don't say too quickly no to something or someone, because it could be a good idea, you know, later on, and you would regret if you didn't take the advantage of it. And so that's my recommendation to an entrepreneur that wants to conquer the world or change the world with another company. But you know, as is true, to always listen to the right people. It's more importantly very, you know, very crucial to not listen to the wrong ones, you know. And in my experience, and I did it by myself, of course, as well, I met a lot of, you know, so-called startup advisors or coaches out there, you know, that even read books but never act as an entrepreneur and are in the board of any kind of startups, you know, but they don't have the experience, you know, to bring you ahead. And that's a bad thing, as you mentioned before, you know, like advisors that are just taking money and you're listening to them, and in the end you couldn't benefit from it because they have no experiences as well or the same level as you have. And so, yeah, always listen to the right people, follow your instinct. And if there are any doubts, listen to your wife, yeah, or partner. So that's a good idea. I almost follow anytime.
Yeah, no, I agree to that. This is sound advice, especially what resonates with me is the point where you mentioned to find the right people to ask for advice. And I think going to people who already achieved what you want to achieve, who already have built a roadmap to the goal, makes a huge difference compared to those who read books about what yes. might happen. Max, thank you very much for this interview. I think we can dig in to more details in many, many topics. I really enjoy talking to you, but I'm pretty sure as a CEO, you have a lot on your agenda. Thank you very much for participating in this podcast. I wish you and your team all the best, and I'm looking forward to hear more success stories from your company.
Thank you, Christian. It was a real pleasure, and I hope the audience liked the journey and some quotes from the past.
I'm absolutely sure. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. Please share the podcast and make sure you've subscribed. Have a great day.